We are talking once again with Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, local writers and activists here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
And we touched on last week, talking about the mayor's race that is finally getting several people tossing their hats in the rings.
Yeah,
and this week was no exception.
I'm sure last week you guys talked about Colleen Echo-Hawk, the executive director of the Chiefs Seattle Club, who is a big fan of Jenny Durkin, and I'm sure is going to draw quite a bit of support from the business community behind
her. She already has, actually.
Oh, yeah. This week, City Council President Lorena Gonzalez announced that she will also be running for mayor. In Gonzalez's case, she made the decision to, quote, ensure that things are actually being implemented, end quote, which was a direct slap at current Mayor Jenny Durkin for not spending money that's been allocated by the City Council when they pass their budgets every year or every other year, and not following through on and sometimes vetoing bills that have been passed by the City Council, particularly this past year in 2020, when some major bills were passed by the City Council that Jenny Durkin then vetoed, and then the council promptly overrode her veto, including a big COVID-19 relief bill and the budget for the remainder of 2020. Both bills were bills that were vetoed by Mayor Jenny Durkin, and then the City Council turned around and said, no, we mean it. We want you to spend this money. And then as the year progressed, Mayor Durkin kind of picked and chose what she wanted to spend money on. She didn't really follow the budget passed by the City Council. So it's not a surprise that Lorena Gonzalez is saying that as she jumps into the mayor's race. Now, it's been expected that she would run for higher office for some time. She's very ambitious. She has a lot of energy.
Yeah, and she initially announced that she was going to run for state attorney general last year before Inslee decided to stay in for a third term, which meant that Bob Ferguson, who wants to run for governor, stayed as attorney general, so she dropped out of the AG race.
Yeah. And
but she already started fundraising for that.
Yeah, and so she's turned her attention now to the mayor's race. Of course, this means that her District 9 seat, a citywide seat on the city council, will be up for grabs this November. So, of course, Sarah Nelson, who co-owns Fremont Brewing and is a pro-business candidate, jumped into the race for the District 9 seat.
Yeah, she's run a former legislative aide for Richard Conlon. That's where she's coming from.
Yeah, and she's run for city council before, back in 2017, for the other citywide seat in District 8, which Teresa Mosqueda won. Mosqueda announced earlier this year that she's running for re-election in that position, and she has yet to draw any opposing candidates in her race. But in the District 9 seat, Nelson is the most prominent candidate so far. Others in the race include two very young candidates, Claire Grant and Isabel Kerner. Kerner ran for the District 7 race, but back in 2019, but she didn't make it through the primary, and for good reason. Others include the perennial candidates David Ishii and Alex Zimmerman, and Rebecca Williamson, who I think is a Socialist Workers Party candidate. So far, Gonzalez and Echo-Hawk are the front runners in the mayor's race, but there are six other candidates who have filed, but the only one who's raised any money so far is Lance Randall of SEED, the Southeast Economic Development Group. He's often called an affordable housing expert, but really he's kind of business development and real estate developer type who could draw, who could have drawn significant pro-business support. But of course, he's not a name candidate like Colleen Echo-Hawk is. Now, whoever wins the mayor's race will have a tough job in 2022, not just steering the city out of the pandemic and an unprecedented economic hole, but also they're going to have to find a new police chief, because Durkin announced that she's not going to bother even starting a nationwide search for a new police chief for the SPD. she's just kind of given up and she's fine with an interim chief of police, just like she's fine with having interim department heads working underneath her in the city government. Mm-hmm. The new mayor is also going to have to probably finish negotiating the contract with the Seattle Police Officers Guild. We know that that can take years, not months. And it's possible that Durkin may leave office without finishing that as well. A new mayor will have to reposition the city's funding for public safety while not violating the consent decree. That's so far been a little bit of a tricky line to walk. This week, the judge, James Robart, who's been overseeing the city's consent decree with the Department of Justice over police accountability, he scolded the city council saying, look, you guys said you were going to cut the Seattle Police Department by 50%, but you didn't think about the consent decree and what the city's responsibilities are under the consent decree to provide public safety to your own citizens. Of course, Lisa Herbold came back and said, hey, you know, we did negotiate a 20% cut for the police department, and we did work with folks within the Seattle Police Department to identify places where we could cut the budget. And when it comes to the attrition at the Seattle Police Department, it was Mayor Durkin who imposed the hiring freeze that led to most of the attrition this year at the Seattle Police Department, which I thought was kind of interesting, you know, the ins and outs.
She's got a point.
Yeah, she's got a point. It's the ins and outs of city politics that Judge James Robart is not familiar with. But those of us who pay attention to it day after day, week after week, year after year, we can see her point and see where this is headed. But, you know, it's going to be a fine line for a mayor and a city council to walk next year when they consider further cuts to the Seattle Police Department. Are these cuts going to be something that the judge, Judge Robart, will approve of? And they're going to have to keep him in the loop as well. And I think that they could both do a better job at that. But a new mayor is also going to have to think about things like funding affordable housing while pulling the city out of an economic downturn, going to have to figure out how to house a record number of homeless people. And that number could increase once the eviction moratorium and the rent moratoria expire.
And they'll be going off of old data because this year there was no point in time survey.
Yeah, exactly. And then they're also going to have to deal with some really difficult transportation issues, including whether to build the city connector streetcar, to fund more protected bike lanes and where, to tackle the street maintenance backlog, which is enormous now, and how to fix the West Seattle Bridge. And then there's the need to find more money for Sound Transit 3, which Seattle is one of the key partners in funding Sound Transit 3, which is beginning to slide into its own new financial sinkhole. So there are a lot of, you know, and there are other questions too, questions of tax reform, equitable budgeting, environmental issues to tackle. The list is long. And
Durkin wants the city to lend $300 million to help salvage this convention center expansion. That's going to be big deal.
Yeah. So, and there's the ongoing, couple of big ongoing infrastructure projects right now with the renovation of Key Arena into the new, Climate Pledge Arena and, the continuing, construction on the waterfront to create the waterfront park. So there's a lot of stuff going on. We're now a big city. You know, we're not sleepy Seattle anymore. And so the mayor's job is a huge job. And we'll see whoever becomes elected if they're going to be up for that big, messy job.
Yeah. And the mayor's office really is getting it from all sides right now. They're getting it from progressives who want more action on things like affordable housing and homelessness, and they're getting it from Seattle's right wing too, which is, you know, led by media outlets like Cairo and Como TV, has you know, yelling a lot about crime and the icky homeless people and all the rest of that. It really is a thankless job right now.
Yeah, and then there's
somebody's got to get it.
And then there's the folks who are just worried about business issues and their property values. You know, you're going to get that in any city, I think. So it's a matter of trying to balance all those different interests and trying to please a whole lot of people coming from a whole lot of different directions. And yeah. It's going to be a really tough job once 2022 starts.
So for the city council opening that's created by Lorena Gonzalez leaving her seat, didn't I see that Shannon Braddock is likely to run as well? She's a pro-business.
She hasn't filed yet.
Yeah, I understand that. But she was a pro-business person from West Seattle who 2 years ago ran for the state senate in the race that Joe Wynn won. And then 4 years ago ran against Lisa Herbolt and very narrowly lost that race.
Yeah, she's someone that the business community could really get behind.
Yeah, so.
So she's a possibility. We'll have to see if she openly files and openly declares.
Yeah, I mean.
There are other folks too.
The problem is that Braddock's constituency is basically the same as Nelson's.
Mm-hmm, yeah. So it would be a choice there between, or they could split the vote. So that may be why Braddock hasn't filed yet.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, and still plenty of time for lots There's of still people.
A lot of time.
Right? Yeah, like another 3 months. So.
Yeah, the filing deadline's in May. So this is the time of year when people throw their hat in the ring. So we'll see.
Yep.
If for no other reason to dry the hat off from getting soaked all. Friggin' winner.
I was
wondering, like, you know, what other garments might get thrown into the ring.
Yeah. All right, let's move on.
Minor
change at the Regional Homelessness Authority.
Yeah, finally, they chose a CEO. First off, I want to say I hate the title of CEO. And I think a government agency should never be run by a CEO. But that's the structure of the new Regional Homelessness Authority.
Yeah, and it tells you a lot where they're coming from, too.
It does, yeah. After a big delay caused in part by the pandemic, the Regional Homelessness Authority has appointed its first leader. There were two finalists. One of them, Mark Dones, calls himself a social entrepreneur. And I don't even really know what that's supposed to mean.
Yeah, I have no idea. It sounds good on a resume, I guess.
I should say themselves, since Mark Dones goes by they and them. Their real job seems to be as a professor at the School of Visual Arts. So, of course, the other finalist was the one who was chosen to head the Regional Homelessness Authority, and that's Regina Cannon. She's the Chief Equity and Impact Officer at C4 Innovations. She has about 18 years of experience working on homelessness, racial justice, criminal justice reform. She's worked with youth, and she's worked with people who have drug dependencies, and she's worked with nonprofits and healthcare providers and governmental entities before. So overall, she looks like a pretty good choice. But she also has a huge job ahead of her. The hardest part of it may be to get Seattle and the other cities in King County on the same page when it comes to providing supportive shelter for a homeless population that's expected to multiply pretty quickly once the rent and eviction moratoria end. So she's a pretty good choice, I think, but there was some controversy surrounding the way that the search process and the interview process was done for this position. There are a number of people who are saying that, well, a lot of this was done in secret, and the new Regional Homelessness Authority may have violated the state's Public Meetings Act. And there may be some further controversy or maybe even a lawsuit around that. But
that's pretty impressive for an agency that doesn't even exist yet. They're already running afoul of this Open Records Act.
Yeah, and I think part of it's because of the COVID-19 pandemic and having to sort of meet safely and trying to get up to speed with virtual meetings. It's a heavy lift and requires a lot of preparation. And right now, the Regional Homelessness Agency is having to do a whole lot of other preparation. So trying to also get up to speed on virtual meetings while they're trying to put together a whole new organization, I think has just kind of overwhelmed them. But we sort of expected that, right? Talking about shifting the county's homelessness response and the city of Seattle's homelessness response into a new regional agency was going to be a pretty difficult task to begin with. You know, to try to do that during a pandemic and to try to also have them get on the same page with doing virtual meetings. On the other hand, you could argue that the city of Seattle, like the city council, made the shift and did it without too much trouble. And the Washington State Legislature made the shift and has done it without too much trouble. So
the point is, though, those were existing organizations, not
yeah,
brand new ones.
That's true. So I think the question is then who's really taken the reins and who's really stepping up and overseeing this transition. It seems to me like it's sort of a hodgepodge that nobody's taken responsibility for, and it may be quite a bit of chaos going on there. I mean, if someone at the county government or someone at the city government were really taking the reins and saying, okay, I'm going to oversee the transition, make sure that this all gets done in an orderly fashion and that we're following all the rules, then we would have seen a pretty open process with virtual meetings set up and so forth. But it just appears to have been extremely chaotic with meetings scheduled, meetings canceled, meeting times changed, you know, no virtual access. Yeah, that's not boding well for the future of the Regional Homelessness Authority.
Okay. All right. Well, moving on to more uplifting news. How about a rundown of what you know about what happened in the legislature this week?
Yeah, there was the passage of some bills in the legislature already, which is kind of unusual. Typically, bills don't pass quite this quickly. Part of it is because the Washington State Legislature has a big job this year that they have to do virtually, and that is the 2-year budget for the state. But they also have to address the pandemic. And so they're prioritizing pandemic related bills, and they're pushing them through really fast so that they can then work on the 2-year budget. So this week, we saw the passage of the COVID-19 relief bill through the House. House Bill 1368 passed it on Monday, and then that bill went into the House, to the Senate Ways and Means Committee on Thursday, which passed it very quickly and moved it on to the Rules Committee in the Senate, which will read through it, do a quick hearing, and probably pass it to the floor next week. And the floor could vote and pass it on to the governor as soon as the following Monday, the 15th.
Yeah, that's very surprising.
That's extremely fast. And that's the bill to allocate $2.2 billion in federal funds for COVID-19 relief. The bulk of it's going to be spent as follows: about $714 million for K-12 schools, with $46 million of that for private schools, $618 million for public health. About 71% of that will be for COVID-19 testing and contact tracing. 16% for grants to laboratories and about 11% for vaccines. $365 million will go to housing, including rental assistance for when the rent moratorium expires in March. $240 million will be for grants to businesses suffering from the lockdown. $65 million will go for immigrants who don't qualify for federal assistance. $50 million will be for child care providers. $26 million will be for food banks and food programs, another $9 million for the food stamp program, and $5 million for other food assistance. And this is all expected to go to the governor's desk for signature by mid-February, so about February 15th or 16th in there. And Inslee is expected to sign it very quickly. Now, another COVID-19 bill that passed the House this week was House Bill 1367. It changes the funding source for $403 million in Medicaid-eligible COVID-19 expenses. Instead of coming out of the federal COVID relief funds, those expenses will be paid out of the state's budget reserves and by federal Medicaid matching funds. This was pretty controversial with the Republican minority caucus, who didn't want to see budget reserves spent on folks with developmental disabilities or in long-term care facilities. They wanted that money to come out of the federal COVID-19 relief funds. The Democrats, on the other hand, feel that this is a really good use of those reserve accounts, and it lets them free up those federal COVID relief funds for the priorities that I listed in House Bill 1368, especially for helping schools to get ready to reopen. Ordinarily, it would take a vote of 3/5 of the legislature to spend money from the budget reserves. However, there are some exceptions to that rule, including when you have a year in which employment growth is less than 1%. And that's certainly the case for 2020. So that's the rule that the House Democrats cited in order to pass House Bill 1367 with a simple majority vote. This bill passed the House on Monday and is currently in the Senate Rules Committee, so it is also passing very quickly, right along hand in hand with House Bill 1368, because it really is a companion bill to that one. And it's also expected to be on the governor's desk as early as February 15th. Now, another bill that is passing very quickly is an unemployment relief bill. ESSB 5061 passed the Senate this week and was sent to the governor's desk just yesterday, Friday, February 5th. It extends unemployment benefits to workers who voluntarily leave employment because they're at high risk of contracting severe COVID-19 or they have someone in their household who's at high risk and they're unable to keep that specific job by working from home. High risk is anyone identified as at high risk by the CDC, including older people and those with underlying health conditions. ESSB 5061 also lowers the maximum unemployment insurance tax rate for employers in Washington state, which is going to provide really significant tax relief, particularly for small businesses who have been hit hard by the massive unemployment tax increase that we've seen this past year because of the huge number of people who are out of work and in addition to the fraud claims that have been processed by the state unemployment department. Now, this bill passed with bipartisan support, a vote of 89-8 in the House and 42-7 in the Senate. So it's expected that Governor Inslee is going to sign it probably as early as this coming Monday. Now, the fourth bill I want to talk about is one that also provides business tax relief. It's another bill that passed the House and is near passage in the Senate. It's SHB 1095. This bill will exempt the state from state taxes any grants or credits provided to businesses by the federal, state, or local governments for COVID-19 relief purposes. That includes exemption from the state B&O tax, from the state's retail sales and use tax, and the state public utility tax. So that's been a big issue for businesses, particularly small businesses, that these grants and credits that businesses are receiving to keep people on their payroll or to keep their doors open or just to keep paying basic expenses so that they can make it through the lockdown, that grant money or those credits might be taxable. That's something that businesses have been going to the federal and state governments saying, help, can you pass a law saying that to forgive us and say that this really should be a grant and not be considered revenue, because it's not revenue, right? So businesses like retailers, restaurants, gyms, hospitality companies, entertainment companies, and even arts organizations and nonprofits have been really worried about this. So this bill is expected to pass very quickly and also be on the governor's desk for signature soon, too.
Yeah, and that's a problem that Congress could have fixed when they appropriated the money, but they didn't. And so every state now is having these controversies and trying to get this kind of a bill passed.
Yeah, and it's possible that now that the Democrats control both the House and Senate and in Congress, that they may pass further, along with a further COVID-19 relief bill, they may pass some wording that will exempt these types of grants and credits from federal taxation. My guess is they probably will. So that's the pattern so far in the state legislature. There's a ton of other bills that are very slowly making their way through the House and Senate, and I'll try to talk about them in future weeks. But for right now, the ones that are getting priority are the COVID-19 relief ones. If you want to track specific bills in the state legislature this year, you can look up bills by their bill number, or you can search for bills by subject matter on the Washington State Legislature's website, leg.wa.gov. Click on bill information on the left to look up bills by their bill number or subject matter. On the main page, you'll see a list of committees that are meeting on the day that you visit the website. Committee meetings are being held virtually this year, so you can watch the committee hearings online, and you can sign up to testify, but you have to do it at least an hour before the start of the committee meeting. Now, that website again is leg.wa.gov, which is kind of easy to remember. It's almost, you could almost make a song out of it. L-E.
All right.
Don't.
W-A.
No.
Dot G-O-V.
No.
kind of like Schoolhouse Rock, right? L-E-G dot W-A
nice.
Dot G-O-V.
G-O-V. Like, I need to contact your landlord. Let him know there's been a gas leak there.
I'm kind of dating myself by remembering Schoolhouse Rock, right?
Yeah, you are, actually.
leg.wa.gov.
Okay. Especially since you were watching it in middle age.
Hey, you got it.
Things Maria does in her afternoons now.
You got to get your fun wherever you can, right?
Yeah, this is what happens when you work from home.
right.
So last week we talked about the $4 hazard pay increase that the city council had pushed. And just quick note to listeners that this week the mayor actually did sign that. Apparently there are some things that she does approve of.
yes.
And it was interesting to see that PCC did a 180 about that same time, where they had been totally resisting, had sent a letter to the mayor against the $4 hazard pay fee increase. And afterwards, they magically changed their tune and now are saying, yes, we're going to do an across-the-board increase for all of our stores in Washington State, I believe they extended it to, in implying that there was something unfair about it just being for Seattle and, you know, and that their hearts were in the right place when they resisted this. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
The other development on that is that Kroger announced a $100 one-time payment for any of their workers who get vaccinated. Now, this is significant because Kroger also, of course, they're a national chain. They own Fred Meyer and QFC locally. And I believe it was Ralph's, which is what they own in Southern California. They closed a couple of those stores in Long Beach this week because Long Beach had passed a similar $4 an hour hazard pay payment for frontline workers. So it'll be interesting to see what happens to QFCs and Fred Meyer's here. And, you know, we're getting a lot of complaints from the grocery industry that this passed very quickly, that the grocery business is a very thin margin, and they can't afford to pay people more.
And a couple of their lobbying groups have filed a lawsuit, although I think the lawsuit probably doesn't have a real good chance of succeeding.
I agree.
Yeah. to try to stop it. And in fact, they're asking the judge to issue a temporary injunction, but I don't think they have good standing for that. And so far the judge has not done that. So the law is actually going into place immediately, and grocery stores are going to be required to pay their workers that extra $4 an hour.
Yeah, and you wonder why something like this wasn't done a year ago when grocery mm-hmm. stores were, you know, first extremely hazardous workplaces.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, well, speaking of lawsuits, there is a civil lawsuit against the Kent Police Department that had developments this week, I believe.
Yes, the city of Kent, the Kent Police Department, and Officer William Davis, who in 2017 shot and killed a young black man, an unarmed young black man named Joseph McDade. Now, McDade was riding with two other young black men, and that apparently was what ran them afoul of Officer Davis. Davis gave chase for what he claimed was expired registration. Presumably he means the tags on the license plate. Once McDade's car was trapped in a cul-de-sac, Davis got out and the car tried to escape. Now, Davis claimed that the car tried to run him over. Federal U.S. District Judge Barbara Rothstein ruled this week is that there's actually no evidence that that McDade, who was unarmed, posed any kind of a threat, or that his car posed a threat, and that the use of deadly force was not justified for appeared not to be justified for what appeared to be a routine traffic stop. So the city of Kent tried to get the lawsuit thrown out. Rothstein ruled against them. So that civil lawsuit trying to hold the city, the police department, and Officer Davis accountable for that death, it's been filed by McDade's family. That looks like it's going to go forward. So we'll see where that winds up, but it will be a very nice win for police accountability if the city of Kent were held responsible for that death.
All right, on to this week's COVID news, starting with Governor Inslee.
Governor Inslee declared two regions in the state could go to phase two. That took effect last Monday. Of course, one of those regions was the Puget Sound region, which included all of Metro Seattle, Pierce, King, and Snohomish County. The other region, Region 1, is Olympia west of the coast, basically. So Thurston, Lewis, Grays Harbor, and Pacific counties. Now, it's not entirely clear why, with the Puget Sound region being the first in the state to identify the British variant as being present in community spread in this region, why Inslee thought it was a good time to try and reopen. That has happened, and so we'll see whether the case counts go up or down or remain relatively flat. They've been slowly declining for the last month or so. The state overall passed 300,000 confirmed cases this week, so it's certainly still a problem in most of the state and here, and I would urge people not to relax and not to let up in their precautions.
Yeah. So what some of those changes are, it includes things like indoor social gatherings of up to five people from two households, outdoor social gatherings of up to 15 people from two households, indoor dining at restaurants at 25% capacity through 11 p.m. at night, although bars that only serve alcohol are still supposed to stay closed. And gyms and fitness centers can reopen at 25% capacity. And then also outdoor sporting events are allowed, but no tournaments. And there's a maximum of 200 people total, including spectators, allowed at these outdoor sporting events. So, again, I agree with Job. I think we're relaxing their requirements too quickly. And that, you know, we saw a surge the last time we went we relaxed the lockdown, you know?
And I said this last week, and I'll say it again, that it's not just Washington State that's had that experience.
Yeah.
Just about every state and most countries that have tried to reopen their economies do so prematurely. And you see a resulting outbreak and surge in coronavirus cases.
Yeah.
It's a very persistent virus, and we need to be learning that lesson and staying clamped down, similar to Australia, New Zealand, Taiwan, Vietnam, some of these other countries, until there's literally no cases from community spread. And we are a long way
from that. Yeah. And, it's really the governor responding to pressure from business, saying, you know, just kind of looking at the numbers of new infections and using that as a guide is not good enough in terms of deciding when to reopen. You know, you got to take into account other factors, like what kind of variants are out there, you know, how sick are people getting, how, you know, are we at the point where we're starting to get close to herd immunity? You know, are we able to do enough testing and contact tracing when people do get sick in order to isolate them and the folks they came in contact with? And none of that is true.
Where are we on a vaccination program? And we're nowhere near where we need to be.
Exactly. So, I mean, when none of those variables are in place, you can't start relaxing your restrictions and expect that case numbers are going to remain low. So, I would urge people to not take advantage of these new opportunities. Stay at home, you know, wear your masks, stay out of indoor gatherings, try not to get together with people outside your household at all. You know, this two household thing is just opening it up for more community spread.
I think it's trouble. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Who's advising
also
counties?
Well, I think it's just, you know, the governor having to respond to pressure from businesses and saying, okay, I've come up with a way to track it. I've come up with a numerical way to set a point when we can start reopening. And so they put in place these numerical measurements of, you know, number of new cases and that's just not enough. It's not good enough.
Maybe someone should look into see what Boeing's stance on this is, because clearly Jay Inslee listens to Boeing.
I think the Washington Restaurant Association has a lot more to
has
do
a
with
lot
it.
To do with it. Yeah, I do too.
The other interesting thing in local COVID news this week was a new report from the Department of Health showing that racial disparities in Washington State are very similar to other states, both in terms of who's getting the virus and who's getting vaccinated for the virus. In other words, non-white populations are vastly overrepresented in the number of cases and the number of deaths, but underrepresented in who's getting vaccinated. All of those things, of course, are very concerning, very similar to what we've seen in other states. The Department of Health really hasn't been publishing racial breakdowns of vaccination data before, so this is new information. And
And they didn't initially publish data on the racial demographics of who was getting COVID-19.
No, that, it took them a long time.
That required an outcry by communities of color. So it's kind of surprising that after all of the discussion that's been had about institutional racism, that there are still, well, maybe not so surprising, that there are still these institutional groups like the Department of Health who are not, you know, paying attention to racial disparities.
I would say not that surprising.
Not that surprising.
All right.
So nationally on COVID this week, we're now at 450,000 deaths, which is just a staggering death toll when you think about it. And we broke a record this week for one-day deaths. We topped 5,000 dead in one day for the first time across the country, which, again, remember, 9/11 was 3,000, and that was a one-time event. that shook the country. And instead, we've been having that kind of scale of death every day for nearly a year now. We saw quite a few more movements by the new Biden administration to try and get vaccines out, particularly. The military approved a FEMA request to mobilize to help with vaccinations. Their first mobilization will be to Southern California. That'll happen toward the end of next week. We found out that the South African variant has 3 new cases now in the state of Maryland. What we know about the South African variant is both that it's extremely contagious and that it has at least some resistance to existing vaccines, which makes it a very worrisome prospect that that's taken root in a major metropolitan area in the United States. These were in suburban D.C.
So it's now in 3 states, South Carolina, Maryland, and then just yesterday, I think there was a reported case in East Virginia.
Yes.
So 3 states now.
Again, the greater D.C. area.
Mm-hmm.
We had Biden invoking the Defense Production Act again yesterday. This was to help with the manufacture and distribution of vaccine. We're slowly making progress. We had a study out of England this week that suggested that, and a study in the U.S. also in nursing homes showing that, hospitalizations of nursing home residents are now dropping. That, of course, in much of the country was one of the first populations that got vaccinated. So we're starting to see the impact of the vaccines. And that can only be good news.
Yeah. I think a more concerning shift is the age, the kind of average age of people who are dying from severe COVID-19 is moving downwards. So younger and younger people are getting it, spreading it, and getting extremely sick, which is putting a lie to the myth that it's only elderly people who get the severe form and die from it.
What we've seen since the first of the year is that the average age of people who
is moving
get
down
and spread the virus is coming down quite a bit.
Yeah.
It's like down into the mid 30s now. It's not elderly people at this point.
Yeah. Also really concerning was this week and the study of the Novavax vaccine that was done in South Africa. The folks who did that study released the official results of their study, and it showed that the mutated form of the virus in South Africa can reinfect people who've already had COVID-19, that having had it before confers no better protection than if you've not had it at all against this mutated strain.
And
that's
again,
extremely concerning.
That particular strain has a couple of mutations that enable it to evade antibodies. So even if you have antibodies, whether it's through a vaccine or through having had previously.
The vaccine does provide better protection against it. And there could be, I think there are some pretty good theories about why vaccinations provide better protection than actually having had the disease. Vaccines can produce a very robust immune system response against an illness. And it can, and the type of antibodies that are produced by a vaccine may be better at detecting broader variants than simply having had the disease before. Think for a minute about flu shots. You know, the flu shot, once you get it, can protect you from multiple variants of the same type of the flu vaccine that you're getting. Whereas sometimes people will get the flu early on in flu season, it gets passed around the community, it mutates, and they get it again towards the end of flu season. So I think there's something there about how vaccines prime the immune system that can protect you better than if you actually get the illness and produce antibodies. So there's something kind of interesting there that isn't fully understood yet about how vaccines prime your immune system, but they appear to be much more effective than if you had gotten sick. Now, what this means is that any calculations that have been made so far about when we reach herd immunity here in the United States have taken into account that people who've already gotten COVID-19 are added into that equation as being immune to future variants. Now, I think they're going to have to roll that back, and that's going to set us back in terms of when we might see herd immunity in the U.S. It means we got to vaccinate people who have already gotten COVID-19.
There's a historical precedent for that, too. A century ago, the Spanish flu came in two major waves. The first wave got a lot of people sick, but it didn't really confer immunity to a lot of people. And the second wave was a more virulent variant.
That's what we're seeing now.
What caused all the mortality.
Mm-hmm. That's what we're seeing now. So, think about it. The COVID-19 is now endemic in the human population, the same way the flu is. Every year we produce a vaccine against the flu that has three or four different strains in it to confer protection against various mutated versions of it. It's possible that that's what we may see with COVID-19 in the future, that we get our flu shot, we get our COVID shot every year, a COVID booster every year against the various strains that are out there.
Yeah, and when we talk about endemic, what we mean is 105 million cases worldwide in a little over a year, which is just incredible when you think about it, that, something like 1 in 70 people in the world have gotten this virus in the last year alone.
Yeah, and that's probably a lowball figure.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Because a lot of countries are undercounting the number of cases and the number of deaths, including the United States, particularly under Donald Trump and various Republican state departments of health.
Yeah.
All right. Anything else on COVID for this week?
No, let's move on.
All right. President Joe Biden did a speech. At the State Department?
At the State Department, yeah. I always like to say when it comes to the president's job, he has two main jobs, if you look at the Constitution. I mean, he does many things, but the two biggest pieces of his job is one, overseeing the laws, the enforcement of the laws of the United States, and number two is foreign policy. And this week, Joe Biden gave a speech on Thursday at the State Department where he outlined the broad features of his foreign policy. Right at the top of that list was recommitting the United States to its global alliances, particularly in Europe and through global organizations. That was right at the top. One of the biggest announcements is that the United States would provide no more support for the war in Yemen, and that he was going to undertake a review of arms sales to Saudi Arabia, and that his government, that the Biden administration would lift sanctions against Yemen. Now, about 250,000 people have died in Yemen, most of them because it's now the worst humanitarian disaster in the world, the continuing carpet bombing of Yemen by Saudi Arabia, using a lot of United States munitions. Fragments of U.S. bombs have been found throughout Yemen, including cluster bombs, which are of particular humanitarian concern because
the Trump administration had also withheld food aid, which has contributed to the humanitarian crisis.
Really contributed to the deaths of many, many Yemeni civilians. So lifting the sanctions is very good news for Yemen. Now, he's also announced in that speech that the Biden administration would increase the number of refugees allowed into the United States. The Trump administration had imposed a complete shutdown, not allowing any refugees in, and they'd used the excuse of the COVID-19 pandemic. But it is certainly possible to allow in refugees who are very close to qualifying to be allowed in if you require them to if you require them to be in lockdown for a certain period of time to prove that they're not infected with COVID-19. And that's what the Biden administration is looking to do. He also made a commitment to human rights, including LGBTQ rights in U.S. foreign policy. And of course, he talked about confronting Russia for its election hacking and confronting China for human rights abuses and aggression, though he didn't speak in a lot of specifics about those. What was interesting to me is that he made no mention of Iran or of renewing the nuclear agreement that was cut under the Obama administration when he was vice president with Iran.
And he oversaw the negotiation of that within the Obama administration.
Yeah, so I found that kind of interesting that he didn't make any mention of that at all. My guess is if he does, and I think he probably will, it's going to be a whole separate speech or a whole separate announcement.
I suspect that they've initiated efforts to negotiate behind the scenes already. And we'll hear something about it when it bears fruit.
Yeah.
If it bears fruit.
When they have something to really announce, it's going to be its own special announcement. So that was the sort of broad strokes of his outline of foreign policy, essentially trying to do a 180. But there was so much damage done by the Trump administration that typically in this first foreign policy speech, we would see a lot more specifics on what a president would focus on. In this case, we saw a whole lot of Biden saying, look, you know, this is a tanker that I have to turn around and steer in the other direction. So he had to kind of speak in very broad strokes about.
Yeah. And part of the challenge for him,
where he's
and
headed.
Part of the reason that he did the speech at the State Department in the first place was that is one of the agencies that was seriously hollowed out under the Trump administration.
Yes.
Rex Tillerson and Mike Pompeo. They lost a lot of career diplomats. They lost a lot of area experts. And that expertise is going to take many, many years to fully replace.
But and repair.
So the first part of his job is really just to try and get, you know, the infrastructure of U.S. diplomacy functional again, because it was really destroyed under the Trump administration.
So he had to kind of.
The last 4 years has completely disregarded experts. It's been one guy's whim and whoever's mm-hmm. getting blackmailed by this week.
Yeah. So he had to kind of speak like a marketing guru. He had to say, hey, this is what the broad strokes of what we're going to try to do is, you know. And he's going to have to leave a lot of the details of rebuilding the department to the people that he appoints to run the State Department. And they're going to have to be doing a whole lot of recruiting to get people back into positions where the U.S. State Department can start functioning like the organization that it was before Donald Trump took office.
And it would be really nice, since this is a problem in a lot of different agencies, particularly environmental regulation, you know, the CDC and the other Harris health groups, you know, agencies whose mission was completely ignored and politicized under Trump. And
corrupted,
corrupted. And a lot of scientists and a lot of career diplomats were driven away. It would be really nice if Congress could act to reinstate them retroactively so that they don't lose their seniority, they don't lose their benefits. And, you know, it's not their fault that they were forced out of their jobs. It's their fault in the sense that they had particular expertise and that expertise was not wanted.
That would be pretty hard. I think a lot of those folks have probably moved on to other jobs in academia or tanks or whatever.
Yeah.
But it would be nice to go back and offer them like a bonus to return to say, hey, you know, your job's here if you want it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And also, you know, reinstituting job protection for civil servants, which is something that Trump gutted as well.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
All right. A couple items of international news this week.
Let's talk about Alexei
Navalny.
Navalny, yes. Mm-hmm. He is in jail again, and was sentenced last week. His wife is in jail as well. This is a Russian dissident and a leading opposition figure to Vladimir Putin. And we have seen major demonstrations across Russia, even in major Siberian cities where it's extremely cold outside this time of year. You know, we've seen those large demonstrations and thousands of people arrested by the Russian government. This is probably the most serious challenge to Vladimir Putin's rule in the 20 plus years that he has been basically running Russia as a dictator. It's interesting that this is happening just as the administration transitions in the United States. Biden in his State Department speech this week was critical of Russia, and he did mention the poisoning of Navalny, but really didn't address the mass arrests that have been going on this past week or two. And the question also is, you know, what kind of leverage does the United States have over Russia right now? We can certainly urge our allies not to buy natural gas from Russia, European allies, but the amount of leverage that the U.S. has is not what it was 4 years ago. And, of course, there's an obvious reason for that.
Yes.
Meanwhile, you've seen major demonstrations and, in one case, a coup in other parts of the world, particularly South and Southeast Asia. You saw a coup in Myanmar, formerly known as Burma, this week, where, the Burmese military had ruled the country for about 20 years. They were the ones who changed the name to Myanmar. And they have taken control of the government once again and arrested the former prime minister. That is very concerning, and again, it's something that the United States really hasn't directly commented on or tried to intervene in. And you've also been seeing mass demonstrations against the king in Thailand for the past several weeks, and for the past couple of weeks, farmers in India also have been mounting major demonstrations. So, while we are focused heavily on domestic news in the United States, there's a lot going on in the world right now, not to mention the COVID infection.
Yeah, keep in mind these demonstrations are happening not just in winter in Siberia, places like Siberia where the weather is really prohibited against this kind of stuff, but also because of the also in spite of the pandemic, and pandemic lockdowns in various places, it's like the police accountability and police reform movements across the country here, and demonstrations against institutional racism here. I mean, these are deeply felt issues, and people want their rights, and they're willing to go out onto the streets and mingle, even in pandemic conditions, even in conditions where the weather is so severe.
Yeah, and India and Russia are the second and fourth worst countries for the pandemic in the world right now. Of course, the U.S. is first.
Mm-hmm. And jumping back to local, you guys remind me while you were talking that last night there was a traditional Friday news dump where SPD Blotter reported that SPD is now up to 6 acknowledged officers that attended the Washington, D.C. rally.
I can't remember who locally. I think maybe it was Lorena Gonzalez who said that the SPD has the highest number of confirmed members who attended the January 6th rally of any police department in the nation so far.
Yeah, which, given that we're 3,000 miles from D.C., is really saying something.
Yeah, and that we've been undertaking a reform process for almost a decade.
Yeah.
Like, hello, this is how difficult it is to change the culture of the Seattle Police Department.
And the culture
in
of
one
SPD,
of the most progressive cities in the country.
The culture of SPD has been a serious problem for decades, and it's not just a race issue. You know, it's a Neanderthal issue, honestly. Mm-hmm. And that kind of mentality is not only not screened for when people are recruited into the department, but it's encouraged within the department as well. And that's something that a succession of different police chiefs has been unable to change.
Mm-hmm.